The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The nonprofit Health Poverty Action recently began a webinar series entitled A World with Drugs, Legal Regulation Through a Development Lens. The first webinar in this series, entitled Drugs Are a Development Issue, An Introduction to Legal Regulation, aired recently. We're going to hear portions of that today. First, Bilisande Mashakata is project coordinator for Umzimvubu Farmers Support Network. UFSN is based in Mpondoland in the Eastern Cape Province of South Africa. The network currently sits on the provincial government-initiated steering committee for the development of the new marijuana industry.
I am Bilisande Mashakata from Umzimvubu Farmers Support Network. I speak representing rural farmers who cultivate cannabis, who have been cultivating cannabis, along with several other rural settlements in South Africa, who have been relying on cultivating cannabis to make money, as well as supplying the underground markets that have been thriving for as far back as cannabis trading can go. Most of these families who do cultivate cannabis in Bondoland, in Limpopo, in KwaZulu-Natal, they do so for the aim of making money rather than for personal consumption. They do use cannabis for traditional remedies, both for humans and for animals, but the core of it is making money for them. Unfortunately, they have been practicing this illicitly underground simply because of prohibitions that come a very long way from over 100 years ago, which have proven to hinder the progress of these families in terms of being completely dependent and self-reliant. And the war on drugs introduction in South Africa has proven to be quite brutal, and especially for these rural small-scale farmers of cannabis, as it was imposed onto these communities via aerial spraying, which would be done by the South African police for many years, and which we stepped in. This is how Umzimvubu Farmer Support Network has come to exist. It came to exist mainly as a reaction to the spraying of these fields. We have assisted the communities in terms of launching a litigation campaign against the South African police. And we are at a point now in South Africa where the government and everybody else that is involved in the development of cannabis can actually play a role in changing the situation, in changing the way that things have been done. If government is really serious about making this a meaningful industry, as they say, for these rural farmers, they do acknowledge that they are seeing them. They know that they've been incarcerated. They know that they've been serving time in jail. They've been brutalized by police. They have been experiencing all kinds of actions. And if they are actually serious, this is the time to do so now by meaningfully engaging these communities. And so far, since the passing of the privacy rule in 2018 September, where the Constitutional Court allowed for individuals in South Africa to cultivate, to possess, and to use cannabis as they see fit, this has come as a really light at the end of the tunnel, but it still speaks to a very small amount of South Africans, as it only opens up for people who have had the interest to grow for themselves. But as you can imagine, there's over 20 million users of cannabis in South Africa, and not all of them have the time or the expertise to cultivate, nor do they have the interest. And more so, a lot of them don't even have the space to do so, because we live in different settings. Some live in rural areas, some in urban areas, and some in informal settlements where there's very little land to none for cultivating. And this needs to change. The privacy ruling needs to engage more, needs to reach out more to communities, find out how they have been using, how it has thrived for so long, this industry, because it has thrived underground. There's never been a time when there hasn't been cannabis cultivation, where there hasn't been all of this trouble that has come about from people cultivating. So that needs to be looked at in the terms of indigenous knowledge, and it needs to be acknowledged. And before the Justice Ministry and everybody else in government that is responsible for shaping the legal framework of how to use cannabis in South Africa can engage with communities, rather than imposing rules and regulations that they don't know how will work. It feels like the passing of the ruling that came in 2018, it feels more like ticking the boxes, such as this new cannabis bill that has been introduced. It hasn't been passed as a law just as yet. It has been introduced, and it has been making its rounds. And now the unfortunate part is that for this as well, it hasn't made its way to the people who are most relevant to the situation of cannabis farming. It has made its way to people who have access to internet, to who are able to read and write. Meanwhile, a lot of people living in these homes that you see in these pictures do not have network coverage for their cell phones, for television. They don't have access to news, and they don't even know there is so much uproar throughout the country regarding the use of cannabis. They know nothing about the bill, and the bill is very serious, because if it were to come into a law, then it would mean that the rural communities of Mpondoland and everywhere else in South Africa will forever be criminalized. They will never ever have a space whereby they can commercialize, where they can fit into this industry whereby everybody else is benefiting. And we find it really unfair that such laws can be passed without actually interacting with the people that are going to be most affected. As you can see, a lot of them are out of reach. They cannot be accessed through access roads. They are not educated. They have not had any formal education. They are unemployed. They live on child grant support as well as elderly grant support. Sometimes an elderly grant support can feed a family of 8 to 20 people per month. Sometimes you have two elderly people, sometimes one elderly person, and no one works within these families. So the shaping of the legal framework in South Africa needs to come to a point whereby we say, We need to design licensing regimes that would be inclusive for these families. We need to design development standards that will include the communities that will be suited for their situations. They need to be engaged formally, meaningfully, as I've already said.
That was Vilesande Mashakata, She's project coordinator for Umzimvubu Farmers Support Network in South Africa. She was speaking on a webinar entitled Drugs Are a Development Issue, an Introduction to Legal Regulation, that was organized recently by the nonprofit Health Poverty Action. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Now let's hear from Dr. Duncan Green. He's Senior Strategic Advisor at Oxfam Great Britain and Professor in Practice in International Development at the London School of Economics. He's author of How Change Happens and From Poverty to Power, How Active Citizens and Effective States Can Change the World. He also writes a daily development blog.
I'm supposed to talk about the drugs and development angle, but actually I don't think I can add much to what Helen and Filisande and Zara have said. And I'm probably the person on this webinar, including all the people attending it, who knows least about drug policy. What I do is watch conversations and ideas rise and fall within the aid and development sector. And I'm really interested in this combination where you appear to have a mix of progress at a national level and real inertia in most of the development sector. Helen Clark is an exception. There are very few conversations. I can't think of a single conversation in Oxfam that I've been in about this issue. So clearly there are some massive blind spots and taboos. So the danger is that in a webinar like this, we all agree violently with each other and then go out and tell everybody this is what you should be doing. And they go, yeah, fine. And nothing changes. So why doesn't change happen? Why isn't the aid sector getting more interested and more involved in this? And it reminds me a bit of a different topic, migration. So on migration, you have a bunch of think tanks and economists who are saying, how can you be so stupid? Migration is great for everybody. It's great for the people who migrate. It's great for the economies who receive the migrants. We've done all the numbers. We've got the evidence. Why won't you listen? And it's a bit like that. So it's a similar sort of block to, actually, I don't think the problem is lack of evidence. And I think just proving you're right again, it's probably not the best way to bring about change. So I'm sorry, as you've just done a whole journal proving that you're right again, but that's my fear. So what could be stopping progress? What could be stopping organizations like Oxfam or international bodies picking up this issue? I think one is, you know, narrative. So drugs, the way drugs is framed, illicit drugs are framed as othered or stigmatized the people you need to involve in finding solutions. So users, producers, traders, and aid agencies are maybe worried about being tarnished by association, either looking like they're sort of supporting crime or they're naive or hippies or whatever. I think there are some real questions about the narrative, which maybe put international NGOs who want to be taken seriously and look really sensible, maybe puts them off. Maybe that's a possibility. Maybe it's just that the standard levers for action, which aid agencies and the people they lobby can take, are not always there. They're weak or non-existent. So one of the interesting things about this is there's an overlap between the focus on borderlands in talking about drugs and the focus on fragile states, which is one of the big issues in aid and development more generally. So aid and development sector is really worried about places where the state doesn't function, because that's basically their main tool, is to get the state to deliver services, run the law, have a effective set of institutions. And when you get places like Somalia or large parts of the Congo where that doesn't work, they're really struggling to find alternatives. And there's an interesting kind of echo there where it's actually a really difficult place to get solutions that fit with the way that the aid sector, development sector work. The aid sector loves win-wins, and I think there's lots of genuine trade-offs in this topic, which are painful. So, I work on Myanmar quite a lot, and there you can see the rise in drug use in Myanmar has become a real issue. It used to be a nice, simple thing that peasants in Peru or Bolivia would grow drugs and Americans would take them, and it's not that simple anymore. So those difficulties and trade-offs, I think, make it difficult. $500 billion a year creates a lot of incentives. It creates a powerful institution that wants to keep things the way they are. That enormous value of illicitness to some people. builds a constituency against change. So I think Zara mentioned, I just put a little poll out on Twitter yesterday and got about 200 replies, totally unscientific. You know, I would mark it really low if anyone did send this to me at the LSE. But it was quite interesting because way the biggest factor that 200 people, and they're just basically aid wonks, you know, development aid wonks, researchers, academics, NGOs. Of the 200, two-thirds said it's reputational risk. Right now, and then 15% said it's not important enough to us, and 15% said we don't know what to do. So in terms of you as a lobby group who are trying to get the aid sector interested, I think it'd be worth starting from there and saying, okay, let's unpack that. What is this reputational risk that people are looking at? Is it that you can't get money for this? One of the replies on Twitter was, I can't see Gates ever funding this, right? I'm not sure about that, but that's what they said. So is it about the funding? Is it about the legal issues around counterterrorism legislation and people really worried about license to operate? Is it about that self-image of not looking serious? You know, it's worth thinking what unpacking that issue of reputational risk. The other things, it's not important enough and don't know what to do, are kind of easier from in terms of where you're at, because you've kind of got answers to that. But I think the reputational risk is a really tough one to crack. Finally, Zara, if I've got time for another minute or two, yeah. So I was just thinking what to do, right? So I think first is really understanding the obstacles. It's proving you're right is a really rubbish advocacy strategy, often. Understanding the obstacles and how to shift them, who might be the right person to have that conversation, what experience, what narrative might shift those obstacles is often better than just proving you're right again. So that's one. Finding the champions. I think I've got my eyes on one. You may not have heard of it, but it's called the Center for Global Development. And they're really quite a centrist think tank based largely in Washington. Everybody's kind of terrified of going in a whole lot of these directions, and somehow that needs to be broken. It's quite interesting, the fetishism around drugs. So, you know, I was just looking at the numbers. 750,000 people dying from illicit drugs versus 8 million dying from tobacco and 3 million dying from alcohol every year, 1.5 million from road traffic. You know, why is drugs so different? I mean, the defetishizing drugs would be kind of interesting. That seems to be happening with a lot of this national legislation. I'm a big fan of looking at success, something which the jargon is positive deviance. So if you can find examples of communities or countries, either historically or currently, who've made it work, who've got out of some of the worst effects of this and learn from them, rather than just doing these big sort of broad statements about drugs. And then keep fighting on process, on the inclusion of the people who need to be in the room, because they're often excluded. None of these are silver bullets, you'll be pleased to hear, but I'm sure if we come back in 10 years' time, something will have changed, because something quite significant will have changed. But boy, is it slow. The first post I had on my blog, From Poverty to Power, on this was 2013, and it was saying, drugs, really important issue. Why is it taboo? And we're having the same conversation now. So hopefully the next 10 years will be better than that.
That was Dr. Duncan Green. He's Senior Strategic Advisor at Oxfam GB and Professor in Practice in International Development at the London School of Economics. He was speaking on a webinar recently entitled Drugs Are a Development Issue, An Introduction to Legal Regulation. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Finally, let's hear from Anne Fordham. Anne directs the work of the International Drugs Policy Consortium, where she leads on international advocacy efforts on drug policy and human rights.
I think, as already clear from the excellent previous speakers, we're at a very exciting juncture in drug policy reform. We are moving beyond the focus that we've had, which has been very important, on the strong critique of the failure of prohibition towards solutions of how to better manage the market through legal regulation and to address some of the serious harms that have been driven by policies that have been narrowly focused on eradicating the drug trade. And it's also important for the development sector to note that these harms have disproportionately been borne by people who are marginalized and in situations of vulnerability. And in reforming these harmful policies, we must ensure that solutions do not further exacerbate inequality, poverty, and exclusion. So it's also, I think, and that's the context of our principles, important to note that legal regulation in and of itself will not be a silver bullet, and it presents some really urgent challenges. As we heard at the very start of the webinar from Helen Clark, we're seeing private investors and corporations rushing in to occupy the newly created legal markets, while the communities that have traditionally cultivated cannabis are being excluded from participation. In countries where legal markets are created mainly for export, small producers are barred from accessing international trade due to technical, legal, and financial barriers, while Global North investors end up owning most of the market. And this is happening even in countries that aim to incentivize the participation of small farmers and traditional growers, like in Colombia and Jamaica. And as already been said, there's a real risk that legal regulation might be more effective than prohibition in ending the livelihoods of traditional growers and further exacerbating and entrenching inequality and poverty, especially if the design and development of these initiatives are left solely in the hands of private interests. So it's really never been more urgent for development organizations to engage in drug policy and for drug policy organizations to engage in issues of social justice and international solidarity. It is to address these critical questions of ensuring social justice and reparations and redress for the war on drugs that is one of the key entry points for IDPC's work on legal regulation. So I am very excited that we're using this moment to launch the first edition of the IDPC Principles for the Responsible Legal Regulation of Cannabis. With these principles, we aim to offer a comprehensive vision of how legal regulation can be used to advance social justice, equity, sustainable development and human rights. As a global network, IDPC members live and work in all regions of the world and in diverse social and political contexts. In some of them, like Canada, governments have legally regulated cannabis for non-medical use. And although there are challenges in Canada, the political debate is more open to discussing drug policy reform. But some of our other members live in countries like Indonesia or the Philippines, where people who use drugs are systematically dehumanized, and advocating for basic rights-based policies comes at great personal risk. Because of this diversity in the situation of our members in the past, we as the Secretariat had been reluctant to kind of encourage the global network to take a strong position on the legal regulation of drugs. However, and this is why things are changing, I think, overall. The context is changing for all of us. Our members have increasingly been calling for greater attention to this issue, especially from a social justice and human rights perspective. You know, the landscape, you know, as we've talked about before, is changing. In recent years, over 50 countries have moved to legally regulate cannabis for either medical or non-medical use. And some of our members report finding more receptive audiences when they argue for regulation than when they've advocated for harm reduction or for the decriminalization of drug use. So legal regulation is now a political reality. It's happening. And as the drug policy and the drug policy and international development communities need to address it. Cannabis is particularly relevant to a development discussion as it's a classic example of the colonial origins, the abysmal failure, and the harms brought about by the international drug control regime. For the last 50 years, cannabis has been scheduled as one of the most dangerous substances in the world, with little therapeutic value, in spite of its rich history of cultural, ceremonial, medicinal, and religious use. The officials that drafted the 1961 UN Single Convention outlawed the traditions and livelihood opportunities of communities in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Cannabis is still the most widely used drug in the world, with over 190 million users. And this exemplifies the futility of the prohibition-based approaches, not only to drug use, but to the cultivation and production of drugs. Although these policies have been ineffective in eradicating drug markets, they've been extremely harmful in how they've affected communities of growers. So one example is in Morocco. In 2017, there were 48,000 traditional growers facing arrest warrants for cultivating cannabis, which is a central, you know, survival livelihood for so many of them. So in this context, the current momentum for the legal regulation of cannabis presents a unique opportunity for the development and drug policy movements to push for recognition of traditional uses, as well as policies that ensure the livelihoods of cultivating communities and to provide redress for the harms they suffered under the war on drugs. The 20 IDPC principles, which is literally just hot off the press, like less than an hour ago, for the responsible regulation of cannabis, are a point of entry into this debate. They explore the full implications of legal regulation to offer a bold vision of how it can help to advance social justice, equity, and human rights globally. We have organized these 20 principles under six headings: the health and human rights of people who use drugs, social justice, inclusive and equitable trade, legal responses to activities outside of the legal market, gender-sensitive approaches, and monitoring and learning. I'm not going to go through all 20, but I just want to highlight five principles that are most relevant for our discussion today. First, to put in place strong affirmative action measures that guarantee the participation of traditional growers and small producers in the new markets. These include financial and technical support, lower regulatory barriers to access, and preferential access to the market. Second, to create the space for the emergence of alternative business models and certifying schemes that distribute power and promote fair and sustainable practices through global supply chains. Third, recognize the value of traditional, cultural, medical, and religious uses of cannabis and create the conditions for their preservation. Fourth, address the challenges deriving from the global prohibition of cannabis for non-medical and non-scientific uses. Under the current system, the international trade on cannabis for non-medical use is banned. This means that growers from the global south are barred from accessing legal markets for adult non-medical use of cannabis and are pushed to continue to source the illegal market. Last but not least, we must decriminalize all activities related to the personal use of any drug, as well as low-level production and trafficking offenses. As I said before, communities that have traditionally cultivated and used cannabis are frequently excluded from the legal market, and they should not be punished for that. I would like to point out, just in closing, that although our new principles concern specifically the regulation of cannabis, this is because of the currency and the urgency of the cannabis discussion, and because of the fact that this was very much a member-led process in developing these principles. However, cannabis is not an exception amongst other drugs and should not be treated exceptionally. The principles that we propose today and the underlying values of social justice, equity, human rights, should and can be extended to the legal regulation of other drugs. And as new initiatives, research, and regulative experiences emerge, we will be looking to expand them and make them longer and more comprehensive. So I really welcome you to read, share, advocate for these freshly launched principles. We hope that they'll be taken up by colleagues in the development sector, in drug policy reform, and specifically those working on changing cannabis policy. As Zara said at the beginning, this is a call to action to ensure that social justice is centered within the hard-fought reform of drug policy that is legal regulation.
That was Anne Fordham. She's executive director of the International Drugs Policy Consortium and was speaking on a webinar entitled Drugs Are a Development Issue, an Introduction to Legal Regulation, that was organized by the nonprofit Health Poverty Action. And that's it for this week. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.